Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, a Congress divided. What is driving it and what are the real consequences? Then, change they can't believe in, a new thorough study of the Tea Party and reactionary politics in America. And finally, how to sustain and restore the green equilibrium that's necessary to support life on Earth. For the third time in the past two decades, an extreme faction of the House of Representatives forced the government to shut down. What's really driving the political tactics in Washington, and what are the long-term consequences and prospects for American democracy? With us are two experts on American politics. Christian Gross is a professor of political science at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Congress in Black and White, Race and Representation in Washington and at Home. David Parker also joins us. He is a professor of political science at Montana State University and the author of The Power of Money in Congressional Campaigns. Welcome, Christian Gross. Welcome, David Parker. Great to have you both here with us on the Scholar Circle. I wanted to start with Congress and the president. When you look at the mass media framing, there's an adequate amount of blame going back and forth, but it seems to be mostly framed as a he said, she said dispute. Christian Gross, would you say that is an accurate portrayal? And if not, is there something more accurate for us to understand what's going on?
I think that's generally accurate, and perhaps, if anything, the framing is suggesting that is putting a decent amount of the blame on the House Republicans. But I think it's mostly about Obama versus House Republicans, and there's not as much about the role of the Senate, because the Senate's controlled by the same party as the president. So I think the president sucks up all of the media attention on the side of the Democratic Party.
So it's being framed, you're saying, as a partisan fight, and that is, in fact, how you would see it, too.
It's definitely been framed as Obama versus Boehner or Obama versus House Republicans. It's a little bit more complex, where I would say that the House Republicans, President Obama, Senate Democrats, all would like the shutdown to end sincerely. They would like that to happen. But for strategic reasons, they don't reach agreements. And I think it started with House Republicans, who are the most conservative members, a majority within the majority party, started much of the road towards the shutdown by trying to put Obamacare, tying it to the continuing resolution on the budget. But then there have been strategic moves by the Democrats subsequently in the Senate to not extend funding on some of the piecemeal bills that would have extended funding from a few of the more popular things like national parks. And so I think that it's hard for me to assess blame necessarily, but I do think that the media frame of Obama versus House Republicans is a little bit more simple than what's actually going on.
David Parker, would you agree? And what would you say is driving the motivation of the shutdown?
I would actually put the blame on two features that encourage this type of behavior. And those features are, number one, Citizens United. And then number two, the other feature that is important is these congressional districts. And I know there's debate in the political science literature about whether this is all gerrymandering. I would say actually has also to do with residential self-selection. But these two factors have created an environment where there is no individual incentive for a lot of members of Congress to cooperate. What is the individual incentive to push a bill that compromises? If you're a House Republican that's conservative from a district that's heavily Republican, your folks in the district, if you come back to them and say, hey, the compromise was to keep Obamacare, you're going to draw a primary challenge, and with Citizens United, you're going to draw that money. The challenge is going to draw a lot of money that it wouldn't have otherwise drawn in an earlier era. So you're putting yourself electorally at risk. So I think those features are more fundamentally problematic that led to this use of government shutdown to try to pursue policy. What's happening here is you have a group that is trying to creatively use tools in ways that really haven't been used before to try to push policy, to create policy, because of the difficulty of creating policy and change in the existing institutional structures, which are fraught with divided government, where it's just, the last Congress passed 200 pieces of legislation. It was like an all-time low. So I think there are bigger features at play here than just the he said, she said argument in the press.
And it sounds like what you're saying is that there are some very serious consequences to this type of divided government.
Absolutely. Essentially here, it's very difficult for either party to get out of this mess because on the left, Democrats don't like the continuing resolution, which has additional spending cuts. And not only that, they certainly don't want to get rid of Obamacare. And on the right, they basically just want to cut spending wherever they can. And there's a principled stand there, too, in the sense that the actuarial projections for Obamacare after the 10-year mark blossom. So there's that there as well. So I'm not sure I see an easy way out of this mess.
Well, Christian Gross, would you agree with some of these structural issues and what the consequences are?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it's structural, and I'm not 100% sure precisely which structure or campaign institution led us to this, because the government didn't shut down last time in the last Congress, even though a lot of the same things happened. So there is something going on that where the impasse occurred in this Congress, which makes it somewhat unique. I do think that a lot of it is related to ideology, right? The Republican Party is ideologically homogenous and more conservative than it's been in a while in Congress, and the Democratic Party is also ideologically homogenous and fairly liberal. There's a few like Democratic moderates and a few Republican moderates, but that's part of the story. I do think that one difference is once you go to the shutdown, all sort of the normal way of behaving changes. The reason there is a he said, she said frame in the media is that whoever wins that frame will be the one who wins this negotiation, and the group that will cave, be it House Republicans or Senate Democrats and President Obama, is going to be who loses the public opinion war. And it goes from before there's a government shutdown, if you say things like bureaucrats and are making too much money and we need to cut the budget, majority of Americans would agree with that. But then after there's a government shutdown and you see a real-life bureaucrat wearing a National Park Service uniform not getting their pay or telling people not to enter national parks, the public also likes the things that money is spent on. Whichever one of those frames wins, and I think that once there's a shutdown, people think about the role of government in ways that push them a little bit more to the left. And by people, I mean the public, that push them a little bit more to the left. While before there's a shutdown, I think that the public is generally fairly conservative on these issues in terms of spending. But I think that whoever ends up winning will be the one whose party image is not tarnished as much. So I think right now they're both tarnished pretty badly, but the Republican Party's image may be getting tarnished even worse. And that's probably also what happened in 1995 when there was last a shutdown for a long time period.
Well, you took me exactly where I wanted to go because of some of your work related to, you were looking at kind of the pork barrel politics. But it's this interesting paradox between people distrusting government, disliking government, but still wanting the government benefits. So there's this kind of fundamental disconnect, and the question about the realization and when that realization comes in. It sounds like what you're saying is, people don't understand what government does, and it's not until this shutdown occurs that they start to understand it.
Well, I think people understand what government does, but they like some of it and they don't like some of it, and they don't think about it that much. But then as soon as you have something as dramatic as a shutdown, you start realizing all sorts of things that many in the American public think are worthwhile spending money on. Maybe if they sat down and created the budget themselves, they wouldn't necessarily come up with this allocation. But the frame shifts so dramatically that it is obviously a negative, and then the question is, do the Republicans get blamed, and thus they will have to cave first? And it would have to tarnish their party image so much that some of these relatively safe members suddenly go from likely, feeling like the party image would be damaged so much that they might have a, I wouldn't say a difficult re-election, but maybe a more difficult re-election than they normally would, where they have to spend more effort than they'd want to. But on the other hand, we're over a year before a general election. So that's the other thing, too. I don't think there's necessarily an electoral incentive for anyone to compromise immediately, even if the party image is tarnished.
Well, David Parker, let's bring you back here. Now, you mentioned Citizens United and party polarization. Scholars often talk about how so much of what's going on today is making the other side look bad. Do you think this is a new normal?
Let me say that politics is always about, hard knock fights, and it always has been to some degree. And, some of the campaigns back in the 19th century were pretty gosh darn vicious as well. What I think is different now is that it's far more ubiquitous and visible with the new media. And I also think that Citizens United creates power structures outside of the political party that force the hands of individual candidates more so than any other era. So, you know, before Citizens United and before the Bipartisan Campaign Finance Reform Act that was passed in 2002, the party could exert a lot of authority on individual candidates because of soft money. All the interest money came through the political parties, and they could use that as leverage. And not only that, party leadership had other carrots and sticks that they could use to enforce discipline, such as earmarks. Well, guess what? We don't have earmarks anymore. We don't have a way to try to encourage individuals to come together. Not only that, earmarks are anathema to conservative Republicans now. You can't touch them. Now you've got these groups that are accountable to nobody except their own donors, who will then come in with, you know, literally millions of dollars to prop up candidacies that in prior existences would have gone nowhere. Look at the situation that happened in Indiana or in Utah with Bob Bennett. Those candidacies in an earlier era probably would have difficulty struggling and getting support. But now you've got people with different objectives that can come in and upend the political environment. The party doesn't have the power that it once did, and Boehner is left with very little tools to basically hot run herd on this caucus. I would not want to be Speaker of the House right now in this environment.
It does not look like a very fun job. Christian Gross, you also looked at the president's role in these types of things, not specifically a shutdown, but how do you see the dynamic with the president having more of a bully pulpit and speaking to the constituencies at large? Does this change the equation at all?
I think that helps a lot with the national coverage in particular. I mean, the day of the shutdown, the first day of the shutdown, I noticed the president was giving a lot more direct interviews to people in the media than he typically does, speaking mostly on the shutdown, but also related to the launch of the healthcare exchanges. So I think that being the president can suck a lot of the attention away in a way that all the individual members of Congress, while in their districts, can do well in their individuals' home states and districts, reaching voters. In terms of the national coverage, it ends up being a whole bunch of different Republicans saying different things. Democratic members are a little quieter and maybe just not getting as much attention because the president, as a Democrat, takes attention from them. But even there's lots of different things being said. Some are focusing on health care. Others are talking about the shutdown. And it's just hard to break through when you're a party of a number of individuals with different interests related to their own states and districts, while the president has a bully pulpit, as you said, to just when he says something, people are going to pay attention.
Then when we look at the past two shutdowns, which were during the Clinton administration, is there anything we can learn from that, or have the dynamics changed enough that it doesn't apply anymore? David Parker?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, basically, I remember that shutdown very well. I mean, what came out of that very clearly is that Clinton won that fight. As it dragged on and dragged on, basically Congress got blamed for it. But the biggest difference that occurred there is really, at the end of the day, both Clinton and the House Republicans agreed on the end goal, which was to balance the budget. They were disagreeing over numbers and how much pain to bring Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Here, I don't know if there's that much agreement at all here between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And not only that, you're dealing with a political environment where even in 95 and 96, you had far more moderates populating both parties, and here they're virtually gone. So on the one hand, while I might say the president, when we went through this before, won hands down, arguably you could say it would be harder to translate any victory, even if Obama wins coming out of this, into any policy action that would be preferable for the Democratic Party. I think we're kind of stuck. Even if he wins the short-term battle, I'm not convinced that we're not going to keep rocketing from crisis to crisis. So if I were the president, I would try to change the game. I would try to do something outside the box in order to basically stop the use of continuing resolutions and stop the use of threats over debt ceilings as a weapon to hold the nation's feet to the fire. So I would try to do something else and maybe not compromise and maybe do something controversial, like look at the language in the 14th Amendment and invoke that if something shuts down or if the debt ceiling becomes an issue.
Christian Gross.
I agree with David for the most part. I think that the 1995-96 shutdown is instructive. I think a lot of what's happened the last few days feels like a replay of what happened back then in the first few days of a shutdown, with just in terms of all the stories about what the impact is that people didn't realize. And I do think, like you said, that I think the environment is different. One difference is the debt limit component, right? So the debt limit expires soon, not yet, but and is not related to the shutdown, but is conflated because there are two deadlines that without action, bad things happen. And then arguably, I think the debt limit expiring is much worse than a government shutdown for the economy broadly. And I've done a little bit of research on the previous debt limit vote 2 years ago, showing that members of Congress were willing to, what I argue is members of Congress are willing to finally compromise on the debt limit the day before the date of expiration because they are concerned about their own personal stock portfolios. The closer they got to a default, the more likely the economy would crash, the stock market would crash, and then those members of Congress who own a lot of stocks were more likely to vote to increase the debt limit, and it was actually ended up being a pretty nonpartisan vote. I don't think that necessarily instructs us for the next couple weeks because these two things are conflated, but if what happened and if what I found in 2011 will hold now, my guess would be the debt limit would they would reach a deal on the debt limit fairly right before when everything's about to go nuts, and then they'll reach a deal, and then it's possible the debt limit will get folded into the continuing resolution shutdown part of it as a broader deal, and so that does make this a little bit different than 1995-96.
So personal finances are determining votes. Is that what you're saying?
It's one component, yeah. I mean, lots of the key factors like political party and constituency factors and so on. But the one component is that, just for instance, not that it's predictive of any individual, John Boehner has substantial investments in the stock market and not elsewhere. And these data are all public because they're elected officials, while some of the other members of the Republican leadership and some of the other members of the Tea Party or self-identified members of the Tea Party are less exposed to the stock market. So it's not necessarily that they're doing it just for their own personal financial interest, but they are more aware of what an economic crash due to default will mean than a member of Congress who owns lots and lots of property. There's one member of Congress who owns tons of apartments all over the Midwest, and like that person isn't potentially as concerned about a debt limit default.
Since you mentioned the Tea Party, let's just end with a bit of analysis about what is going on with these Tea Party Republicans and what their real motivation may be, because it seems like they're the ones that are driving this agenda. David Parker, what do you know about this?
Well, one of the things I think the Tea Party is very clear on is they basically believe that the government has gotten too large and taken away some fundamental freedoms that they see as violating the dreams of the founders and the intent of the Constitution. So I think their stance, as they see it, is incredibly principled. And when you have an incredibly principled stance and you believe that if you compromise on that stance, you're violating some fundamental precepts, the basis for compromise goes away. There was an article written a number of years ago now by James Davison Hunter, which talks about how difficult it is to compromise between essentially individuals aren't speaking the same language. And I think the Tea Party folks are not necessarily speaking the same language. They're not speaking the language of governance. They're speaking the language of what they believe the Constitution dictates that they should do. So I think, at the end of the day, this group is going to be intransient throughout. They're not going to stop or fold on this. They don't want ACA to continue. And frankly, as far as they're concerned, I think they see the government shutdown as fine because they see government is doing a lot of things that are fundamentally not necessary and, more importantly, not within government's purview. So I think they hope that the government shutdown is going to show other people that we can live normal lives and we potentially can live better lives without this government. Now, I agree with Christian. I think one of the things from their perspective that's bad is that when people start seeing that they can't get their national park or they can't do this or they can't do X in their daily lives or get to a website they need some information, they start to question. They see the positive effect of government, which is exactly why I don't think the Senate Democrats are going to cave and fund government by piecemeal, because I think they lose a lot of leverage.
Christian Gross.
The one thing about the Tea Party members, you know, it's a collective group that's somewhat loose in terms of what exactly it means to be Tea Party member, but I agree it is related to their philosophy, and it reminds me a lot of this is where it does remind me of the people who won after 1994, similar to the ones who won after 2010. They came in and they have ideologies, but some of them were not used to the political system and the compromises, even when you are strongly ideological, that you have to make to be successful in the political system. And so I see that happening today with the shutdown, and that's really similar to what happened with some of the new Republican freshmen who were part of the cause of the shutdown in 1995 and 96.
Thank you both so much for joining us here. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Christian Gross is a professor of political science at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Congress in Black and White, Race and Representation in Washington and at Home. David Parker is a professor of political science at Montana State University and the author of The Power of Money in Congressional Campaigns. When we come back, Change They Can't Believe In, a new, thorough study of the Tea Party and reactionary politics in America. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The Tea Party Republicans have gained an enormous amount of power since the group's emergence. More recently, they've challenged the Republican leadership and persuaded it to shut the government down. It's but one of numerous policy positions on which the group is gaining ground. Our next guest has done an in-depth study of the group for the new book, Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Matt Barreto is a professor of political science at the University of Washington and the director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He is the author of Ethnic Cues, The Role of Shared Ethnicity in Latino Political Participation, and co-author with Christopher Parker of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Matt Barreto. It's great to have you back with us.
It's my pleasure, Maria.
So it sounds like your findings in this new book of yours on the Tea Party is that the basis of the party's attraction really deals with a fear and a fear of change.
Yeah, we call it a reactionary conservatism, that they are having this sort of moment of anxiety and reactionary politics in which the changing demographics in the country and the symbolic election of an African-American as the president of the United States has really caused them to sort of wonder if this change that Obama was standing for was change they believe in or not, hence the title. And we find overwhelming evidence from interviews with Tea Party sympathizers themselves that they're very frustrated, anxious, and opposed to these changing America.
There are things about the book that I thought were quite interesting. One is that you see the Tea Party as sort of a continuation of the past kind of reactionary politics, and you reflected on Richard Hofstadter's work and reiterated some of his findings. Let's first go back, and if you could refresh us on Hofstadter's findings and then reflect how the Tea Party are similar but also different from those earlier versions.
Yes, we try to draw, you know, extensively on the sort of historical tenets and movements that have taken place in America over especially the 20th century. And we look at the Klan of the 20s, and we also look at the Birch Society, the John Birchers in the 50s and 60s. And, you know, Hofstadter is really writing at a time where he's seeing this sort of reactionary politics first taking shape. And we really draw very heavily on the theoretical and empirical observations that he was able to make. And what he really laid out well was that it wasn't just about policy incongruence, that it wasn't really just about an ideological opposition, but that there was something deeper, that there was a sense of paranoia on the parts of these movements in how they were reactionary and how they were reacting to the changing times that these were taking place in. And we really draw on that and draw parallels between that paranoia, in particular, that paranoia and conspiracy-minded thinking that Hofstadter outlined, and what we see today with the sort of birther movement, with the Kenyan witch doctor posters that we saw at some of these Tea Party rallies, with the socialist takeover of America, a lot of the same things that Hofstadter had identified we think are happening again today, and that there's this sort of cyclical fashion. So we try to draw on where America has been, how has America politically changed over the years, and when we've seen these movements on the right, what have they stood for? We realized that we didn't have to start from scratch when describing the Tea Party today.
Now, cyclical indicates that it may be short-lived. Is that your suspicion?
Well, one of the things that we think is that the Tea Party certainly has more legs than just the 2010 election. Some of the people were ready to really write them off after the 2010 election and looking at the victory in 2012. We don't think that's the case at all, and I think we're sort of vindicated in that in where we stand today with the government shutdown. This was really led by a very strong anti-Obama Tea Party effort. It really was not just about, you know, spending and debt limits and these other sorts of things. I mean, it was about the Obamacare and their opposition to that. So we think they're still there. We think they're going to be there through the entire second term and maybe even into the next possible Democratic administration. But at some point, the demographics are going to overwhelm their reality. They will sort of age out of the movement. We don't anticipate a bunch of 90-year-old Tea Partiers still sort of carrying on 20 years down the road. But I think they're here for a good, maybe 10 years.
When you opened the book, you described really two different variants in two different states of Tea Party events and seemingly ideologies. Do you think now, based on your research, that's really kind of fragmented, or do you see more cohesion in the group?
I think there's actually starting to become a little bit more cohesion. There can be a healthy debate on this topic, so I don't think it's settled. But the only example I can give you is that, Chris Parker and I have done a couple of successive surveys on this topic. And in the book, we go through at least two of the national surveys we've done. But in other work we've done, and including the work we did in 2010 and 2011, and then comparing some stuff we did in 2012, we saw the size of the Tea Party sympathizers and what we call true believers shrink. So the overall sympathy and support for the Tea Party, went down nationally from perhaps 30% to 25% to 22%. But we found as that happened, the quote true believers, they got stronger, they got more united, and we saw some even more unified response in some of our questions. That is, the people that stuck with it over these last 4 years, 3 to 4 years, have really sort of hardened their beliefs. They're more opposed to the healthcare law than ever, even after the Supreme Court ruling. They're more opposed to Obama. And we continue to find belief in some of the conspiracy theory stuff, such as Obama doesn't have a true birth certificate. That still remains a very, very popular belief today.
And that he's trying to destroy the country and these types of really extreme thoughts about the president.
Absolutely. There was a quote from former President George W. Bush about halfway through the Obama administration, or actually just before the 2012 election. I take that back. It was just about a year ago, where he said they asked him, did he agree with some of these sentiments that the Tea Party was espousing, that they hoped Obama would fail? And former President George W. Bush, sort of embodied what we call the mainstream or traditional conservatives. Point of view, in which he said he disagreed with some of Obama's policies, but he never would wish for his president to fail. And he used that language. He said, Obama is my president, and I don't want him to fail. I disagree with some of his policy viewpoints. And we really see a divergence there between the sort of the David Brooks and the Tea Party, which they're really rooting for Obama to fail. They have conspiratorial viewpoints about Obama. And they're willing to do things like oppose the debt ceiling raise and the government shutdown, which you see now in the House, the sort of traditional mainstream conservatives coming out and opposing and saying, this isn't good for the country. We need to pick our fights. And the Tea Party is unwilling to do that. We think they're very, very motivated by opposition to Obama and opposition to what his election stood for. that changing demographic and changing times in America.
One of the examples that you pulled out in comparison to, say, the John Birch Society was the move to try to impeach the Chief Justice at the time, Earl Warren, and it was just kind of this virulence because they thought he was trying to destroy the country. Now, they failed there, but they didn't have the same kind of power that they have today.
You know, that's right. But some of those efforts were the same. You know, these ideas that everything was somehow connected to communism, that there was a communist plot to take over the country, and then identifying, you know, some of those key political figures who were associated with it. I would say that one of the differences is a bit of the organization, and this may be due to the sort of technological advancements and the ability to organize online, is that it seems that as compared to the Birchers, the Tea Party today is more politically organized. That is really fielding candidates, taking on incumbent Republicans, taking on primary challenges, and running candidates for office. Certainly there were candidates, Republican candidates, in the 50s and 60s who supported the John Birch Society movement, but it wasn't organized in the same fashion in which the Tea Party is really, and this is one of the things in the book that we give them credit for. From just a sort of a small d democracy, democratic standpoint, they're very engaged in politics. They're, you know, filling out petitions. They're calling congressmen and complaining. They're fielding candidates. They're going to protests. We saw that difference. In the 60s, the sort of the movement on the right was very conspiratorial, but they weren't nearly as politically organized in fielding and successfully winning as many Senate and House seats as the Tea Party has done today in 2010 and beyond.
We recently had Keith Poole and his two co-authors for their recent book, Political Bubbles, on here. And they had a section of that book where they contrasted the Tea Party with the Occupy Wall Street movement and said the big difference was the Tea Party managed to work within the democratic system, in the institutions, field candidates, support policies. That is quite a remarkable achievement that they have penetrated the system in this way. And there have been, and as you noted, some very important consequences. Let's talk about some of these policies that they have been championing. For example, the legislation in Arizona.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were directly tied to the Arizona SB 1070 anti-immigrant and racial profiling legislation that was passed. And ultimately, three-quarters of it were struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. They've been tied to the legislation in Alabama and Georgia and other states, so very, very strongly tied to anti-immigrant legislation. Also very, very strongly tied to some of the more recent voter suppression efforts, cutting back the number of days polling places are open. And because they have now candidates, not just in the Congress, but in state legislatures, who have won, who hold office, that's one of the reasons that that Chris and I believe that they'll have a few more longer-lasting legs than previous social movements. It's not just a social movement. It is a social movement. Let's not forget that. But it's a political movement in that they now have political representation, and they have political office. It's very hard to defeat incumbent U.S. senators. It's very hard to defeat incumbent members of the House or even state legislature. So they're working as both a protest movement, but also as people writing legislation and voting yes or no. And on this, you know, point, is again, as we point to the government shutdown of today, it's clear that those were the voices who were meeting with John Boehner and imploring him to not allow the vote to go forward. And so they have power on both the outside as a protest movement, but also on the inside. And that's something that sets them apart, not just from Occupy Wall Street, but some of the movements we saw in our nation's past.
One of the other bits of literature that you drew on was Michael Rogan, who wrote about political demonology. And I wonder how come this demonizing the other is so attractive to a huge number of people, because you looked not just at Tea Party members, but the supporters.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's not just about the members. And that's an important point about the book, is that the people who actually consider themselves sort of members of the Tea Party, who have been to one protest rally or another, you know, might end up being much smaller. We know that it takes a lot of time and energy, but what we were hitting on was that there's a lot of people who are sympathizing, who are sort of on their couches cheering the Tea Party along, who will vote for those candidates. And so we wanted to open it up and to really talk about the people who sympathized and empathized with this movement and what was their profile. And what we found was that there's millions. There are millions of Americans continue today. As I said, the numbers have shrunk a little bit, but they're very united and passionate about this political cause, and they tend to be slightly better educated, slightly higher in income, male, white or Anglo, and over 50. And so you take that profile of that person who has lived through 50 years of changing America and seeing how the tides have shifted, how we now have a black president, we have a Hispanic Supreme Court justice, we have the U.S. military fully integrating gays and lesbians, but that is a lot of change that otherwise mainstream conservatives, which may have described them years ago, are really now having trouble coping with and are frustrated about. And it's not just the people you see at the rallies, but we found the very same opinions and just as strong among the people who had not yet attended a rally. And so we think it really has a depth and a breadth to it that is quite interesting.
The other thing that you mentioned in your book was that race was a factor and the sort of conservative values are a factor, but not necessarily the driving force. And yet there were people that were still supporters and didn't support the same hatred, say, for the president. How do we explain that?
Yeah, the thing that unites them the most is definitely their opposition to Obama at this point. As the starting point and as in a continuation, those are the areas where we see near, you know, 90% agreement on some of those issues. But as you note, there's variation. You know, sometimes what we're finding is that the Tea Party sympathizers are more supportive of some of these viewpoints, not necessarily that 100% of them do support that. The one myth that we wanted to rule out early on in our book was that they are not driven by government spending and taxes, as some of their very early signs suggested. Taxed enough already was the original signs. And what we found were that when we looked at their viewpoints on government spending and taxes, it wasn't that they weren't willing to be taxed or that the government couldn't spend money on things like Social Security and Medicare. They were very concerned with who was benefiting from that. And that's where it really became this sort of us versus them and just this rejection of the idea that the younger, less white population in America was on the same footing as them. We think that this had been building up for a while and that it was the election of Barack Obama which really was the catalyst that symbolized that change. Right before their very eyes, so to speak. And so there are many, many things present. It's definitely a more conservative ideological group. They are generally opposed to government spending, but that is not at all, when we put these all together in a regression model, that is not at all what is driving the Tea Party. It is really that paranoia, that anxiety over the changing America, and beliefs about Obama.
You looked at whether or not they practice what they preach with regards to things such as civil liberties. What were your findings with regards to their preaching civil liberties and what their policies ultimately supported?
Yeah, I think this was probably one of our unintended chapters of the book, because we really did sort of go in and try to focus in on the race question. They had really racialized Obama, and we looked at that. And yes, we found that they're very racially conservative, anti-immigrant, anti-gay and lesbian. But when we looked at the civil liberties areas, we were expecting to see more consistency. But what we found was that Tea Party members are very willing to allow for the suspension of civil liberties as long as they don't suspect they are going to be targeted. So they're completely in support of things like racial profiling. They're in support of wiretapping and these other things that are happening if you tell them that somehow it could be related to terrorism. And across the board, as we delved deeper into these ideas of civil liberties, we realized that they were willing to give up civil liberties because they didn't think that their group would be affected. And so they were perfectly willing to allow the government to entrench in the area of civil liberties as long as it was for an outgroup, as long as it was for someone who wasn't them. And they were perfectly willing to sort of put these arguments at the forefront. I thought that was a particularly interesting finding, given all of the blowback over the recent NSA spying and everything that people are accusing them of doing. I think politically, you see a lot of Tea Party supporters coming out and saying now that they're opposed to that because it's tied to the Obama administration. But when we privately asked them in these anonymous surveys, they were telling us that they were fine with that. because as long as it wasn't their personal phone, they were happy with the idea that the government could be spying on other Americans.
Well, Matt Barreto, thank you so much for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
Maria, it was my pleasure.
Matt Barreto is a professor of political science at the University of Washington and the director of the Washington Institute for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He is the author of Ethnic Cues, The Role of Shared Ethnicity in Latino Political Participation, and co-author with Christopher Parker of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. When we come back, how to sustain and restore the green equilibrium that's necessary to support life on Earth. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The planet's ecosystems survive and evolve in part because of the balance among the inhabitants within them. Our next guest explores how, in the face of environmental challenges and environmental destruction, we can restore and sustain the green equilibrium that's necessary to support life on Earth. Christopher Wills is a professor emeritus of biological sciences at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Green Equilibrium, The Vital Balance of Humans and Nature, and The Darwinian Tourist, Viewing the World Through Evolutionary Eyes. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Christopher Wills. It's great to have you here with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Miriam.
You opened the book with a real scenario in Tanzania to explain your concepts, and you describe what's happening to the ecosystem there as an example. At first, the human impacts to the environment there seemed small, but then they escalated. Can you explain to us what happened and how that relates to what's happening in ecosystems all over the world?
The fascinating thing about Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania, now many of your listeners may actually have gone there, it's an extremely popular tourist destination. It's really an isolated ecosystem at the moment. It's surrounded by a lot of agricultural land and so on. So the crater, it's an old volcanic crater. The crater is really a remarkably intact slice. It used to be the great ecosystems of East Africa. So you've got big cats there, you've got all kinds of grazing animals, you've got many different kinds of plants. It really is a self-sustaining system, but small and isolated, and this has been a big problem. As tourists visited the crater more and more, there was pressure to try to keep the place looking nice. And so as a result, just as with the western forest in America, there was a big push to prevent fire. And this meant the grasses grew up and they didn't die back or get burned back the way they would have done. And not just the grasses, but the insects and the other disease-bearing organisms that are associated with the grasses essentially began to build up as well. And so within the crater, what you found was that ticks in particular, ticks are related to the insects, ticks really began to build up, and the ticks, which really dined on the animals, you could imagine, you know, it's sort of like Lyme disease, and only there are many more diseases carried by the ticks in the animal that affect the animals in Africa. These ticks began to build up, and they really began to damage the animal populations. Animals were dying, grazing animals were dying, big cats were dying. And it wasn't until a number of ecologists and park rangers got together and realized that they had to reestablish the balance by reintroducing controlled burning that they were able to bring this under control. Now, the point about this equilibrium, which is one of the green equilibria I talk about in the book, is that it is a balance of life and death, just as everything else is in the natural world. organisms have got to die in order to keep the system in balance. And, of course, the ticks are an essential part of the ecosystem. You cannot really run a balanced ecosystem without them. But too many ticks throws the ecosystem out of balance. Too few ticks, and the animals begin to multiply, and the whole system gets thrown out the other way. And so, the essence of this first part of the book is to look at how you can establish and maintain such delicate equilibria, often by having by doing fairly small things to the balance. It's surprising how a small change can have an enormous impact. We're seeing that happening now with the introduction of wolves into Yellowstone. All kinds of amazing things are happening there. And in a way, this is really exciting because it shows you how a small change can really have a huge magnifying effect.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting about your book and the way you link this all together is how this balance of nature is on the really on the genetic level rather than on the species level.
Well, of course, we always think of ecosystems as being collections of species, which they are. And at the species level, one species increases in numbers. This may change the numbers of other species that are affected by it. That's something I think that everyone intuitively understands. But a geneticist will look at this system and say, wow, not only do you have all these species in the system, but every species carries a pool of genes. And that pool of genes actually can have a huge number of different variant types of genes, the geneticists call them alleles. And these different varieties of the genes provide every species with an enormous pool of genetic variation that the species is able to rearrange and use as it evolves. This is a whole new level of complexity which people tend to miss when they just think of ecosystems as a bunch of species interacting with each other. It's way more complicated than that, and from the scientific standpoint, way more exciting.
And then you also talked in your book, Green Equilibrium, about how these changes are never permanent. They change each other, and there's sort of this forever altered dynamic that continues.
Oh, exactly. As evolution continues, all the conditions will change. I give a lot of examples in the book of ecosystems that have changed very dramatically, even over the last few hundred or the last few thousand years, sometimes because of human impact, sometimes because other things have changed. Continents drift, mountain ranges build up, floods take place, the weather pattern will change, all kinds of things are constantly altering the natural world. And the natural world has always been able to survive this because of this huge store of evolutionary know-how, so to speak, that these organisms have accumulated. That's the most exciting thing, and that's the great danger. If we start knocking down the numbers of different animals and plants, we not only knock down the species, we're also removing perhaps absolutely essential combinations of genes that the species of the ecosystem need in order to survive.
So then each time we have a change in the ecology, the species has to change its own genetic equilibria too.
Absolutely. And that's much, much easier if you've already got some pre-existing equilibria. There are some species that have very little genetic variation. They might have gone through a very dramatic reduction in numbers in the past. One thinks, for example, of the elephant seals here on the west coast of America. Elephant seals have very little genetic variation because they were very nearly driven to extinction about 100 years ago. Now, they are doing okay at the moment, but they don't have that cushion, so to speak, that extra dimension of genetic variability that they might need in order to be able to survive yet another dramatic environmental change.
And then for us as humans, some of this has been good and bad, you've said. We've got this great range of abilities, more than other species, but it's also kind of made us a potentially lethal force for the planet. How do you explain this?
Well, in a way, we're altogether too successful. We've got these huge brains. We've got the ability to communicate with each other. We have the ability to use tools. We are by far the cleverest organism in terms of manipulating things. Some of our close great ape relatives are rather good at using tools, but nothing like us. We really have gone off in this direction, primarily because it's been a big advantage to us. As we've altered our environment, we have literally evolved to keep up with that. And what we see as in our species is the result of that evolution between us and our developing technology and our developing ability to communicate. So all that means that we are a unique species in two respects. First of all, we're clever enough to be able to destroy the planet. That's pretty scary. But we're also clever enough to be able to save it. That's the trade-off that I think we really have to confront. How are we going to be able to break free of the superstitions and the ignorance that have bedeviled our species for so long and confront the reality of the planet, how it really works, and how we can become a part of the planet rather than fighting it and simply exploiting it?
Throughout the book, you actually opened with it and you closed with it, talking about how, if we can start to really understand these ecosystem rules, we can undo the damage that we have done and in some cases are continuing to do. Are there some examples that you can look at, in addition to the Tanzania example, that we can draw from, especially with the major issues like climate change, these types of things? Are there ways that we can start to understand this to reverse the damage?
Yes, I think there are. We are, there have been many books, of course, written about how the planet is falling apart and we're helping the process, and it makes for pretty gloomy reading. What I've tried to do in this book is to try to look a little bit on the less gloomy side and say, what are the things that we're doing right? Well, some of the things that we're doing right are rather surprising. If you look, for example, at the total number of people who died, the actual numbers of people who died of starvation in the 19th century, and the numbers who died of starvation in the 20th century, more people died of starvation in the 19th than the 20th. We tend, because of course we just live in the present, most of us do, we tend to forget how dreadful the world really was a generation or two ago. And whole new generations of people are growing up who forget how sometimes we can make dramatic changes for the better. Here in California, we've done some amazing things with things like air quality and water quality. We are bedeviled by the fact that California's population continues to grow, that the demands on using resources are continually increasing. But we have done an amazing amount of cleaning up our environment, and I've been able to watch this over the last half century or so. It's been really quite remarkable. So as we look at these dreadful problems that seem at first to be absolutely insuperable, absolutely unsolvable, we have to remember that we have gone through this before. And there's a big difference now. We've destroyed ecosystems in the past, in the Middle East. The beautiful, wonderful ecosystems of the Middle East are largely gone now, or so badly damaged that there's not a great deal left. And this is indeed one of the problems of that part of the world, that the ecosystems have been so badly altered. And all that happened long before people realized what they were doing. So what I think we're launched into now is a world in which, yes, we have terrible problems coming up, but we know what the problems are. We know, at least to some extent at least, the kinds of things that we can do to solve them. So am I an optimist? Yes, I think I am.
Well, optimism is good as long as it's grounded in reality, which you seem to be. Can you think of some additional ways that people have managed to restore ecosystems? You gave an example towards the end of the book. I believe it was New Guinea.
New Guinea is an area where some very, I think, exciting things are happening. I visited two fairly remote regions of New Guinea where the local tribal peoples have come together to preserve and protect a variety of different absolutely unique ecosystems. one in particular in the eastern part of New Guinea, where a huge amount of land in the highlands has been set aside to protect the highly endangered tree kangaroos, and in the process protect a lot of other things that are up there as well. This is being done in conjunction with some help from other parts of the world, but the local people are really taking an enormous role in this, and I was really struck as I talked with them, in particular some of the tribal leaders, how on top of things they were, how determined they were to succeed, and how they are becoming more and more understanding of just how important to their own way of life the preservation of their environment is.
Now, as we look to the future, there have been some projections by the United Nations that the population may exceed 9 billion people on this planet. Do you see that as hard to surmount, or do you think that that is also something that we can deal with in a balanced way, given the ecological needs of the planet?
The planet has exploded. The amazing thing, I think, is that in spite of the gigantic increase in numbers of people, the average human lifespan has gone up dramatically over the last few decades, amazingly so, to the point where in Asia, taking all of Asia, essentially, so you're talking here about a couple of billion people, the mean lifespan has increased by almost a year for every 2 years that's gone by from the 1960s down to the present time. It's just an astounding effect of public health, of transportation, of the ability to raise more food, all these things. Now, what we haven't done is caught up with the necessity to have, let's face it, fewer babies. We're going to have to face up to the fact that we're simply going to have fewer offspring. And when we do, as many parts of the planet are starting to do, we will begin to see some of the awful environmental problems begin to melt away. And I suspect that combined with changing technology, a reduction in the rate of population growth, and in some cases an actual decline in population growth, is going to have a surprising multiplier effect.
Christopher Wills, author of Green Equilibrium, The Vital Balance of Humans and Nature, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, I was delighted.
Christopher Wills is a professor emeritus of biological sciences at the University of California, San Diego, and the author of Green Equilibrium, The Vital Balance of Humans and Nature. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to everybody who made this show possible. Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Fatemuk Alemen. If you missed any part of the show, you can go back to the KPFK audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can follow us at Armudian or like us on Facebook. See you next week.